This episode of Metatrex is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and to help Trek FM at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international program of the nonprofit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org. Want to join the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field. We look forward to seeing you there.
This is Tim Russ, Lieutenant Commander Tuvok on Star Trek Voyager, and you're listening to Trek FM.
There's no greater challenge than the study of philosophy.
My philosophy is that there is room for all philosophies on this station.
Hi everyone, and welcome to episode 87 of Metatrex, Trek FM show on Star Trek and philosophy. My name is Zachary Frueling, and with me, as he always is Mike Morrison. Today, we are going to be discussing what is, in Star Trek fan circles, a controversial episode of Star Trek. These are the Voyages, the final episode of Star Trek Enterprise, your favorite Star Trek show.
My favorite Star Trek show. And Zachary, I have to say, this was a tough call for me because Enterprise is my favorite series in Star Trek. I have to say TOS is a favorite because of the nostalgia of it. It's the Star Trek I grew up on. There are elements that I love about each iteration of Star Trek, and I don't dislike any one of them. But I have to say that second to the nostalgia that I feel watching TOS, Enterprise is my favorite. That being said, these last three episodes of the fourth season, which in my humble opinion is one of the best seasons of Star Trek bar none, are three of my least favorite episodes. I've never really been a big fan of the Mirror Universe episodes, and that kind of ended up being sort of an end to the series. And then we got this little nugget. These are the Voyages, which, you know, anyone who's read any of the interviews with Brannon Braga and, you know, knows anything about the kind of the inner workings of the production of Star Trek know that this was kind of a misfire on their part, that what they had intended to be a love letter to Star Trek fans really fell flat for most of us. And I'm one of those fans. But that being said, I have some appreciation for this episode in that I have been able to really take it in for what I believe it is, and that is Riker's visit, basically, to a history book, kind of opening the pages of a history book and gleaning some wisdom from its pages, a la the holodeck. So with that, I do have some appreciation for this, but I've got to say there are fans out there who just absolutely reject this episode, despise this episode. I'm not so far as saying that I'm a hater, but you know, I'm kind of in that camp myself. And so, but here we are, we're going to talk about it. And I think there are some excellent elements, some good philosophy that we can pull out of this, and some insights I think that we can offer for this, you know, for this final installment of Star Trek Enterprise.
I think the fact that this episode is not a fan favorite episode is part of the reason I was excited to talk about it on Metatrex today. It's always fun to take an episode that is underappreciated and find some good nuggets of philosophy or nuggets of wisdom, some sort of insight that we can draw out of it, and we plan to do that here today. But I have a slightly different take on this episode than you do. I did not get invested in Enterprise the way you did during Enterprise's first run. And I remember when this episode was announced that they were going to be revisiting The Next Generation. I was so excited for this. Even though the episode fell a little flat, it was so fun for me to see Riker and Troy and some sets from The Next Generation reconstructed And it was amazing. It was kind of a Valentine or a love letter to Star Trek fans for me. And at the time, this was going to be the final episode of Star Trek on television for the foreseeable future. There was there were no plans for a new Star Trek series. Presumably, there would eventually be a new Star Trek series. And here we have it now in the form of Star Trek Discovery, which took over a decade to make. So it's been a long time. And the producers of this episode knew that this was likely to be the last episode of Star Trek on television for a long time. And they had the uncomfortable burden of trying to wrap up the last, at the time, 18 years of Star Trek. Star Trek had been on television continuously for 18 years.
Yes.
And they needed to bookend that entire run of Star Trek and find some meaning for Star Trek as a whole and give fans something interesting to look at. You know, revisiting The Next Generation sounded like a great idea. And squeeze in some meaning at the same time. And there are some interesting issues in this episode, like revisiting the past for current wisdom, like the issues of conflicting duties with Commander Riker and his duties to Captain Picard and his duties to Starfleet and his duties to treaties and things like that. So there are great nuggets of philosophy in the episode. And I think the episode does a pretty admirable job of trying to take all of that burden, put all of 18 years of Star Trek on its shoulders and do something visually interesting and have some meaning and wrap up Enterprise at the same time and do all of that in a couple of hours. And I think it did a pretty good job of doing that given all of those constraints.
Yeah, I have to agree with you to some degree. I will say that had this episode happened in the middle of the season or at the beginning of the season or not the last episode, I probably would have been more receptive to it. It's interesting to me that this so-called love letter to Star Trek fans really, at least for me, as someone who comes to this from a perspective of having just loved Star Trek Enterprise, it didn't seem to me like a love letter to Enterprise fans, but rather Next Generation fans. We got Riker, we got Deanna Troi, we got to hear Data's voice, we got to see reconstructions of 1701D, and you know. But as I watched the episode, it feels very forced. I struggle trying to make sense of what it is that Riker is really trying to find there in the holodeck, because I don't see a lot of concourse between what happens, presumably, during this last, you know, we'll call it last mission after 10 years out in space. You know, they're on their way back for this historic moment. And I just have a difficult time finding the concourse between what's going on there and what Riker is dealing with in his struggle, his crisis of loyalty, this conflict that he's facing, you know, between, you know, should I keep my vow of silence and remain, you know, loyal to Pressman, or should I spill my guts to Picard? And I just don't see the concourse. So it seems very forced to me. I struggle making sense of it.
Well, I think you hit on the fundamental plot point problem in this episode, that the analogy between the situation on Enterprise and the situation on the Enterprise D with Commander Riker are only very loosely analogous. I mean, it seems to boil down to the fact that Commander Riker is faced with the decision of whether to violate his oath of secrecy, of silence about the situation with the Pegasus, and his loyalty to his former commander, Admiral Pressman. And somehow that situation with Commander Riker is supposed to be analogous with the situation with Trip Tucker on Enterprise, who disobeys an order from Captain Archer, eventually leading to his own death. And it all seems to boil down to the fact that they have in common that they've broken order. And there doesn't seem to be much else analogous about these two situations. So one thing I don't want to do when we're talking about this episode, I don't want to spend too much time focusing on the disanalogy between what's going on in the Enterprise D and what's going on in Enterprise, because I don't think that's going to be very fruitful. I think it's only a loose connection at best. But I do think each of the two settings has some interesting philosophical material. On the Enterprise D, we've got the issue of Commander Riker's conflicting duties to his former commanding officers, to his current commanding officer, to his obligation to Starfleet, to uphold treaties that have been made. It's a very interesting practical case of conflicting duties in a Kantian sense. I think from the perspective of the Enterprise D, there's an interesting issue of, what our relationship to the past should be. How do we look to the past to guide us in the present? What kind of inspiration, what kind of clarity does the past bring? To what extent are we bound by the lessons of the past? To what extent can we free ourselves in the present and not be constrained by what happened in the past? Ultimately, no matter what Commander Riker experiences in the holodeck when he's recreating the situation on the old Enterprise, it's still ultimately on his shoulders, and it doesn't actually relieve the burden of the situation that he's in. It's not like it's solved the issue for him. He still has to make a decision about what he's going to do. So it's a very interesting existential moment for him as well, not being able to look to someone else's authority or look to the past and have that absolutely settle the issues of the present. So there's some interesting stuff going on from the perspective of the present and the Enterprise D in that episode. But there's also some interesting stuff in the time frame of Enterprise. I think the question of whether Captain Archer really does have a responsibility to Shran, does he owe Shran for Shran's help? The very concept of owing someone something, quid pro quo, loyalty, those are interesting concepts that are only vaguely defined. And this episode strongly relies on a sense of loyalty and quid pro quo. I helped you, so you owe me. And that is the underlying principle that sets the scene in the Enterprise time frame. Even though it's just on the holodeck. Also in the Enterprise time frame, we have the issue of turning points in history. After 10 years on Enterprise, Captain Archer is about to go sign the Federation Charter. It's an important moment in future history in the Star Trek universe. Here in the real world, history is replete with turning points. Moments like the signing of the Declaration of Independence, major world wars, treaties being signed, these grand scale turning points in history. And we get to see one of these turning points in Federation history that we've never seen before. And it's really fascinating to me to see that come to fruition. So we could spend a little time talking about the philosophy of history as it relates to this episode. So I guess my ultimate point, though, to kick off the discussion is that I just don't find the connection between the two timeframes very interesting. I find it only a loose connection at best, but each time frame in the episode seems to offer some really interesting material that we can talk about.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. You and I talked in the Turbo Lift that there's virtually no connection between what's going on in Riker's life at that moment, you know, at this moment in his history.
Except Riker gets to play Guinan.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and you know, that's one of the fun things that I want to touch on as we're talking about this, is his opportunity here to not just observe history, but he does it really from four perspectives. He looks at it objectively, and he also inserts himself into that history by basically playing three different characters in that historical moment. A bridge officer, of course, Chef, that I think probably most people who have watched this episode remember him playing Chef. But then he also inserted himself into a scenario as a Mako. And I have to say, you know, Jonathan Frakes looks pretty sharp in a Mako uniform. So, you know, having that opportunity to really check out history from this kind of neat, circumspect point of view, where he's able to look at it from different points and different places and take it in from different perspectives, I think is super fascinating.
In an interesting way, Mike, the scenes with Commander Riker playing Chef on Enterprise harkens way back to the pilot episode of the original Star Trek series, when Captain Pike is talking to Dr. Boyce inside Captain Pike's quarters, and Dr. Boyce tells him, "People will tell their bartender things they will never tell their doctor."
And as Riker was made aware by Deanna Troi, Chef was the closest thing that the NX-01 had to a counselor. So, and that was really neat, because in many ways, Chef was this faceless character. The only thing that we ever really saw of Chef throughout the entire series were his feet. It was kind of like, it reminded me of Wilson from Home Improvement back in the 90s. You just saw him from the eyes up.
Well, that's another example. I mean, this is a truism, I think, about human communication. There are the official channels, the official discussions we have to have, right? The conversations with your coworkers, the conversations with your boss, the conversations in relationships, the conversations out in public, the conversations in a public sphere in government, right? These are the official things that go on. And then there are the unofficial conversations, the conversations that are silent between friends, the conversations with your bartender when no one's listening, mm-hmm. the conversations in a coffee shop while your cappuccino is being made, right? These are conversations that reveal certain truths about human nature that would go hidden in a public forum. These aren't the official parts of human nature. These aren't the things we like to observe and admit about ourselves, but there are truths that are out there that take a certain context to be able to come to light, and only happens in certain kinds of conversations, in certain settings. And one-on-one conversation with a chef on Enterprise is a perfect example of that kind of private conversation that reveals a truth that isn't out there for the world to see.
For sure. And in many ways, anytime I'm watching Enterprise and there's a reference to Chef, I have to say that I can't help but picture Jonathan Frakes in that role. I'm glad you mentioned that, Zachary, because and this is really a discussion for probably a whole other podcast. But I do want to say that in some ways, that's a I won't call it a problem point or a pressure point or anything like that, pain point or anything like that. But here's one of the difficulties that I have with this episode. And for that matter, there have been similar episodes of Star Trek where these things have happened. You're going back and you're doing a holodeck simulation of a historical event. And because Commander Riker is inserting himself into the program as chef, he's not privy to those private conversations that take place. So he basically has to wing it, if you will. And so in many ways, this holodeck simulation has to extrapolate. And so I have some problems with that. So in the episode, Tripp and T'Pol are talking about the conversations that each of them had with Chef, and they're reminiscing their intimate relationship that is now 6 years in the past. They've kind of in some ways gone their separate ways, although they're serving together there on the ship. You know, they each have gone their own way, and they've left their relationship in the past, 6 years in the past. And so, you know, there they are because of the conversations that they've had with Chef that probably didn't happen, or maybe they did, or that's just it. I don't know. You know, there they are in this historical document, so to speak, this holodeck simulation that is the equivalent of a historical document, having a conversation about, you know, gee, do you miss me? Well, yeah, now that you mention it, you know, I talked to Chef today and I miss you too. And, you know, don't worry, you know, no matter what happens, we're always going to stay connected. And so that's one of my problems, because they're presenting that as, you know, as fact, when in fact it was an extrapolation. Again, that's a conversation for another podcast, but I just have to throw it in there as one of my issues, I think, with these are the voyages.
Well, there's always a hermeneutical problem when it comes to historical events. No matter how complete of a historical record you have, you don't have access to the private conversations. You don't always understand the context. You don't understand someone's inner life. All you have is the outer evidence of their actions and sure, their intentions and whatnot. So sure, even if there were a complete graphical record of what actually happened in those events on Enterprise, you know, visual records and video records and whatnot, and those were somehow preserved all the way into the 24th century, there would still be this interpretive element of what happened in private, you know, where the cameras aren't live. And, mm-hmm, you know, as you participate in the program, how does the program evolve into a plausible series of events based on the things you as the observer or the participant in Commander Riker's case add to the events that are going on? You know, maybe let's just have some smart holodeck artificial intelligence in the 24th century that can extrapolate and give you a plausible scenario.
And that is one of the, I'm glad you mentioned hermeneutics, having studied hermeneutics for many, many years, going back to my college days, and I studied it from a biblical interpretation standpoint. That's the point of view that I first fell in love with hermeneutics. And, you know, the fun thing about it is, you know, you basically are looking at something and you're asking some questions. You know, what did this mean at the time it was written? you know, what does it mean to me now? And you're trying to look at it in context, and you're pulling it out of context. And so that's one of the things that I find really fascinating about this episode, is there's a lot of room for these hermeneutical examinations of what's going on inside this episode, because it is a historical event that Riker is sitting in on. And, you know, certainly when we sit in a history class, whether we think back to, you know, a high school classroom or a college lecture, or maybe it's a great historical book that we've read, we don't really get the full picture. And there is a lot of filling in of the blanks. We sensationalize, for instance, Washington's crossing of the Delaware. And we do that in our writing. We do that in artwork. And, you know, this is this moment in history that we've captured as one of those pivotal defining moments. But I'm almost certain that had we been there, it would have been much less glamorous and sensationalized. And so I watched this episode with that perspective.
Wouldn't you like to have been privy to the private conversations between General Washington and his private chef?
Truly, you know. Well, you know, it's funny because Riker says to Troy inside the episode, and I have to say, for callbacks, this episode really is full of callbacks, especially to the Next Generation. There's a toast. Archer and Tripp are toasting whiskey, and the toast was, "Here's to the Next Generation." Malcolm is talking to Tripp inside the episode, and, you know, they're just kind of looking around in disbelief that, you know, 10 years, even poor Travis is still a lowly ensign. You know, you think Harry Kim had it bad. Try 10 years and you're still an ensign. You know, poor Travis. But, you know, they're looking around in disbelief, and Malcolm says all good things. And so there are lots of these really great little callbacks. I love this. You talk about existential crisis. I mean, they're going through Riker and Troy, and you know, what, no fish tank? You know, how could Archer survive without a fish tank? That's their existence. So there are lots of these great callbacks, but I love Commander Riker's observation that Reed is shorter than he imagined that he would be. And so that's, you know, to me, that's something very tangible. You know, I think that people, for instance, you know, we mentioned Washington, don't realize that he was a very tall man. And, you know, do we always, you know, if we had the opportunity to go back and be a witness to history, you know, be it time travel or be it a holodeck, if we had an opportunity to go back and be a witness to history, you know, what are the things that we would just look at and say, wow, that is not the way I imagined it?
Well, there are two separate problems that overlap a little bit. One problem is the accurate recreation of the past, which is always going to be problematic for all the reasons we've mentioned. But then there's the problem of finding meaning in the past. What does it mean for us today? What lessons can we learn from the past? And I think that second question for me is a little more interesting, because the accurate recreation of the past is mainly a question of accuracy. The more information we have, the more stuff we can throw into the holodeck computer, and the more accurate of a program we can create, right? You know, and that's getting better because we have visual records now, and, you know, these podcasts are a record of conversations, and in the last, you know, 50 or 60 years, we've got, you know, live television broadcasts of a great many things. And our ability to accurately capture the past has increased hundreds of fold in the last, you know, several decades. So that problem is interesting, because I think the problem is actually, that first problem, the problem of the accurate recreation of the past, is actually declining a little bit. But the second problem, the problem of finding meaning in the past and applying it to our situation today, I find interesting, because on the one hand, there are situations in the past that are analogous. There are important lessons that we've learned from the past. You know, there are the classic examples like the Holocaust, right? Don't do that again. You know, you want to remember those lessons and learn those lessons. But what I find interesting about the situation here in These Are the Voyages is that the lesson Commander Riker is trying to learn, it's not don't repeat the Holocaust. it's a little more personal. He's looking for a situation that's analogous to the personal crisis that he is facing, a decision that he has to make, looking to see what someone in the past that is respectable or well-known has done in a similar situation and trying to apply it to his own life. On the one hand, that's interesting because you can look at past events, at the tapestry of how different people have responded to analogous situations, and you can use those to fuel your imagination about what the possibilities are for your own situation. I think that kind of hypothetical historical reasoning is really interesting. You can say, oh, well, in this situation, George Washington did blah, blah, blah. But in this situation, Genghis Khan did blah, 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 blah. In the Star Trek universe, captains can always look back and go, oh, well, in this situation, here's what Captain Kirk did. Or in this situation, here's what Captain Pike did. Or in here's this situation, here's what Captain Sulu did. And you know, use that to inform their judgment about current events, their own situations. So on the one hand, I find that kind of reasoning really useful because we do need to kind of hypothetically imagine different outcomes and different possible, mm-hmm. you know, responses to a situation that you happen to be in. But on the other hand, it doesn't relieve the burden of command, right? You still have to decide what to do in the present. You can look at all the advice from anyone you ask for advice. You can look at all the historical events you want. And ultimately, if you have a situation in the present, you still have to put it all on your shoulders and decide what to do. It doesn't actually relieve the burden of choice here in the present.
For sure. And we all love it when Star Trek does this, right? We all know Janeway has kind of a Kirk crush going on. And she has this appreciation for Captain Kirk and for that period of Federation history. And, you know, we love it when the next generation brings Scotty on board and we love those moments. We love those callbacks. We love the fact that there is a history here in the Star Trek universe. And truly, I think it's one of the many things that distinguishes Star Trek. I mean, we have now 6 series over 51 years, and it's got this rich history, and they can call back to one another. We refer to it as canon. And speaking of canon, I know the canonistas are going to have me for lunch for saying this, but you know, there's actually a chapter 2 to this story in the book The Good That Men Do, and we find out that this particular hologram has a history of its own, and it's one that is deceptive in many ways. And so we know that history always has a perspective, a point of view. It's always slanted, if you will. It's always biased to some degree. There, you can look at any historical event and recognize that, you know, there are 2 stories, and what, you know, what we may call one thing, perhaps another group would refer to it by another name, and they would see it from a different perspective. What could be one country's shining moment could be another country's pain point. And so we recognize that, and we understand that oftentimes there's an untold history that bears seeking out and understanding. And I think that that's true here within this episode. I will say that in Riker's pursuit, and I think Riker's doing the right thing by calling up, you know, a historical moment and getting some inspiration. We all do that. I do that with Star Trek. You know, when I'm going through a difficult time, when I'm, you know, when I'm facing a decision, when I've got problems that I need to face and things that I need to deal with, you know, I go to different sources for inspiration. I go to the Bible. I go to history. I go to Star Trek, like any good Star Trek fan does. I go to my Twitter feed and I see what's the Picard management tip for the day. So I think Riker's doing the right thing. And I think Riker's doing what I think any of us would do in his situation. And I think there is something that he can gain from it. It's just, there are 2 issues here. There's the issue of loyalty. And we can look at this really one-sided when we think about loyalty. You know, he's kind of we're focusing on Trip, but we forget that Archer has that crisis too when he's trying to decide, you know, is he going to help Strand out? And I think that's just as much that idea of loyalty that Archer was facing, I think, really spoke to Riker's situation as well. So I think Riker is really, in a lot of ways, all of us, you know, who are facing a decision or a tough time, and, you know, we're going to the pages of history, or we're going to Star Trek, or we're going to a good book, or whatever it may be, for inspiration and ideas on how best to deal with what we're dealing with.
I think an interesting way to look at reading history or reading biographies, that kind of thing, is to think of it kind of like Stoic training. It puts things in perspective. You realize that other people have had to face crises that are way worse than anything you're facing. People have reacted in such bad ways compared to all the possibilities you're entertaining. And 9 times out of 10, you realize that the situation you're in or the decisions that you're going to make are nowhere near as bad as the things that have happened in world history. And worst case scenario, if you don't make it through it, you'll realize that you're just a moment in history and that it won't really matter in 100 years or 1,000 years anyway. So you can kind of think of reading history or reading biographies as putting all of life into perspective, all of the decisions you have to make, all of the crises you're in, all of the situations you're in, and putting those in perspective and realizing that none of it is as bad as the things you're worried about, that it could be a lot worse. So, that almost sounds like something that would come from Marcus Aurelius, you know, kind of trying to imagine the worst possible situations, imagine your own death, imagine the death of people you know, and just imagine the worst case scenario that could happen and look at all the bad things that have happened in history. And then you realize, hey, even if the worst possible scenario unfolds, that's not too bad in the grand scheme of things right here in the present. So that kind of stoic perspective on the past, I find really interesting because it de-escalates the crisis of whatever you're in.
I was going to say, some people read Marcus Aurelius, Riker goes to the holodeck.
Yeah, it's very similar, exactly. But again, I find it interesting that the past doesn't relieve the burden of the present. Like, Mike, you've been a minister. You've had people come to you for advice.
Sure.
You know, I'm in this crisis. What do I do? And you will say, put on your minister hat, and you'll say, you should do blah, 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 blah. That would probably be the right thing to do in this situation. And what are people's responses to that kind of advice?
Yeah, I rarely tell people what they should do. Rather, I generally will start a kind of a thought experiment, and I simply try to guide them in making the right decision. So I'm not really one to oftentimes give advice, but I think truly if we have an opportunity to pause, and I think that's what Riker's doing here. I think in many ways, you know, he could go to Deanna Troi and he could say, Deanna, you got to tell me what to do. He could call his father. He could do a lot of things. I mean, he could go to Picard with a hypothetical. And so he's got all of these options. But I think Riker does the right thing here. He begins a thought experiment in the holodeck. And he inserts himself into, you know, this unfolding scenario. And he thinks through his own crisis. And at the end of the episode, you know, he makes a choice. He makes a decision.
It's almost like it's putting all of life on pause. He can't deal with the crisis that he's in, the situation with the Pegasus and his former commander. So the fact that he can't deal with it means he's got to find some other way to approach it. So he checks out, goes to the holodeck, finds something relevant, and that gives him kind of the mental room to decide what he's going to do.
For sure. And again, even though I feel like what is going on, and I don't want to dwell on this. I'm like you, I don't want to dwell on this, but I just simply have to say it again. You know, I think it's difficult to find the continuity there because there are two situations I think that he's looking at that had they had 2 episodes to flesh this out and allow it to unfold in a more organic way rather than it feeling so forced, I think it would have made a whole lot of sense. But I'll say it again. I really think that he did the right thing. And I think there's actually a lot of wisdom in this episode for people who are facing crisis. And I think you said it best. You hit the pause button and you know, be it something inspirational, be it a good, you know, Marcus Aurelius is a great example. I mean, I've gone to books of philosophy and books of history and books of inspiration and movies, TV shows. I mean, I've gone to every outlet possible to find inspiration, to speak to my crisis and say, oh, yeah, this, you know, and you oftentimes you walk away and you go, oh yeah, easy decision. I don't know why I didn't think of that. But it's just I just read a great book called Thinking Fast and Slow. And it's a business title, but it's a great book, and it kind of talks about that a little bit. It's about being able to slow down and make good decisions, but then again, keeping your feet on the ground and once you've made the decision, hit the ground running and execute.
Well, while we're talking about Commander Riker, let's talk about the situation that Commander Riker is in. What I find interesting about this episode, probably the most interesting philosophical thing about the episode, as much as I find the issue about historical interpretation and our finding meaning in the past here today, I find those very interesting. But philosophically, I think the biggest issue in this episode is probably the issue of conflicting loyalties or conflicting duties. If you remember your Kantian ethics, Mike... Ethics for Kant is a matter of acting out of duty towards the right thing to do.
Yes.
Whatever the principles that are the most moral principles, what he calls the categorical imperatives mm-hmm. that are right and always right, regardless of context, regardless of outcomes, these principle-based rights and wrongs. Acting out of duty to those is what makes moral worth for Kant. And so Riker is in a real bind. He's got conflicting loyalties. He has more than one duty, and these duties seem to contradict each other. He's got a duty to Captain Picard to tell his current commander the truth of the situation. He's got a loyalty to his former commander, who outranks his current commander, who's now an admiral. So there's a hierarchical, you know, power relationship at play. So he certainly has a loyalty to Admiral Pressman merely because he's an admiral, much less his loyalty to his former commander. And he has a duty to the Federation as a whole and the treaties that the Federation has signed not to create a cloaking device. And probably other things we could think of in the episode if we really try to think of other duties at play. But there are at least three different duties, I think, at play in this episode, and they all seem to conflict with each other. Captain Picard is saying, tell me the truth. I need to know what's going on because I don't want to put the Enterprise at risk, and you seem to know more about the situation than I do, so you need to tell me what's going on. And Riker doesn't want to do that because he's under orders from Admiral Pressman not to reveal any information about this cloaking device that the Federation had been working on. And at the same time, Riker has a duty to the Federation as a whole, the oath he took as a Starfleet officer to uphold the principles of the Federation and the laws of the Federation. So regardless of Captain Picard and Admiral Pressman, he's got this broader duty that's at play. So at least three different duties, and these three seem to conflict with each other. And I think what's interesting is the way in which this duty-based ethics, this idea that you should find the right thing to do and act out of duty to that in some sort of simplistic sense, doesn't really account for the complexity of the many overlapping and sometimes conflicting duties that we have to our friends and public and, you know, your duties to your job or whatever it is. These obligations conflict with each other.
I think you hit the nail on the head early in what you were saying there, and that is that, you know, Captain Picard really reminds Riker of, honestly, his first duty. His first duty is not to Riker, it's not to Pressman, it's not even to the Federation. Captain Picard reminds Riker of his duty to the truth. And that really is the first duty, I think, for everyone. And I think that sits squarely into that Kantian point of view that you mentioned. It is our first duty. And aside from what's happening here in These Are the Voyages, I think ultimately what, at least within the context of the episode, The Pegasus, I think what made a difference in Riker's mind and in his heart was that reminder that his first duty is always, always, always to the truth. And so that in many ways makes these are the voyages something that is really unnecessary. But, I'm glad in many ways that they did it because, again, I think it's pretty cool that, you know, Riker goes in and he gets inspiration from history. But I love the fact that inside the episode, The Pegasus, you know, Riker was reminded by his captain, by someone. And this is what I think Trip Tucker really cued him into is Trip was talking about people who you really trust. And I think that he stirred something up in Riker that Riker realized in that moment that, yes, Jean-Luc Picard is one of those people that I know will be there for me, you know, when I'm on the mountaintop and when I'm in the deepest valley. He's there at my best and he'll be there at my worst. And that's a man I can trust. And, you know, I think that was a tipping point inside this episode. These are the voyages, but I truly believe that the greatest argument was actually made by Jean-Luc Picard in the episode The Pegasus, and that was Riker's duty to the truth.
Well, those aren't quite the same thing, right? Riker's loyalty to Captain Picard, because Captain Picard is always going to be there for him, he has the most loyalty, is not the same thing about revealing the situation with a cloaking device to Captain Picard out of a duty to the truth. Right, loyalty to Captain Picard and loyalty to the truth are not the same thing. So which is the primary motivation for Riker in this situation?
Yeah, and it's not entirely clear. I mean, if you watch just the Pegasus, and that's, you know, that's your entire context for your understanding of what's going on here at this moment in Riker's life, you would think that, you know, it was ultimately his sense of duty to the truth. But you know, we're talking about these are the voyages, and I think that they make it a question of loyalty to Pressman or loyalty to Picard.
Well, what do you think Admiral Pressman would say if Riker said to him, I have a duty to the truth, and so I'm going to tell Captain Picard about the Pegasus? I think Pressman would say, that is absolutely naive, Commander Riker.
Yeah, sure he would.
The political reality of our situation with the Romulans or the gamesmanship of having an adversary like the Romulans.
The truth will plunge the Federation into war, Riker.
Yes, exactly. It can't be as naive and simplistic as a duty to the truth, because the truth is dangerous in this situation.
Sure. Absolutely.
So trust no one. Go all X-Files on it. Conspiracy theory.
Yeah, this is...
Well, that's essentially what happened. You can't handle the truth moment.
Yeah. It really is a you can't handle the truth moment inside. And I think these two episodes, they really go together. And I will say, for someone, if you're out there and you're going, and I'm just going to go out on a limb here, that there might be someone out there listening who has never seen the episode of Star Trek Enterprise, These Are the Voyages. I will say to you, it would really behoove you to go watch the episode of The Next Generation, The Pegasus, and then watch These Are the Voyages, because they don't always do a great job. Although it's explained, it's just kind of whitewashed, what's going on. And you almost have to be a fan to really understand the callback to the episode, The Pegasus. So, you know, I will say that it probably would be difficult for, you know, a casual fan maybe to understand what's happening inside this episode. But, it's one of those, you can't handle the truth moments. And that's what happens inside the Pegasus. I mean, Riker does go to Pressman, loosely with that argument, and, you know, Pressman basically tells him he's out of his mind, and if he succumbs to this sense of duty to the truth, he's gonna plunge the Federation into war, and it's gonna cause all kind of problems, and he's gonna end up in a Federation prison, and so.
Well, I don't mean to sound like a conspiracy theorist here, but that's essentially what's going on, right? That if the truth is so dangerous that it needs to be suppressed, that conflicts with this kind of Kantian high-minded ideal that the truth is the most important factor, right? That we have this, you know, pure duty to the truth, no matter what the consequences, no matter what the practical reality. You know, if you're in the government, if you're in the CIA, you're going to have a totally different perspective on the role of truth and your duty to the truth.
Well, and that kind of flies in the face, too, of what I think a lot of people in many ways associate Star Trek with. This, you said high-minded, and I think that's a fair description, you know, in irony quotes, high-minded. But in reality, it's very much like the real world. I mean, we have Section 31, we have covert things going on, we have starships in the Federation that have cloaking technology, and we cover up deaths, by the way, and we assassinate Romulan dignitaries in this Federation. You know, this high-minded, this Kantian ideal, this utopian world that we've created, we call the Federation, I think is very much like our own, and it's got a very dark underbelly, Zachary.
This is a very postmodern line of reasoning, the dark underbelly of truth. Well, you know, there are a couple of things here, right? One is, the truth can be dangerous. If people knew I'm sure it's true in the real world, right? If we knew the full reality of the political situation or our situation with adversaries in other nations, we would be absolutely shocked. I have no doubt that we don't have the full picture, and we don't want to have the full picture. You know, we sleep better at night if we don't have the full picture. Then there's the fact that there are those dark underbelly things, the Section 31 elements, that if we want to continue to have a comfortable, you know, pseudo safe life, then this dirty work has to happen behind the scenes in order to uplift, you know, the day-to-day reality and give everyone their illusions of, mm-hmm. of safety. In both situations, truth is an illusion. Truth is it's almost a manufactured concept for the sake of pacifying the public.
Well, that's this episode. That really is this episode of Enterprise in a nutshell. It's all an illusion. The whole thing is an illusion. It's a hologram simulation that is an illusion, especially if you read The Good That Men Do. It's all an illusion. So I think that's a great description of what's going on here in These Are the Voyages. It's fake. It's fake news. it's all an illusion.
Well, again, I think what's interesting, though, comparing this to the real world, right? In Star Trek, you've got the holodeck. So yes, it's fake. It's in the holodeck. You can kind of explicitly say this is real, this is fake. Even in the situation with the Pegasus, right, with the cloaking device, it's like, okay, there's a truth of the matter, and then there's a cover-up, right? It's very black and white. You can draw a pretty good demarcation line between those two interpretations. Here in the real world, I think it's more complicated. I think we have the ability to manufacture truth. Right? We it's not a matter of being in the holodeck. It's a matter of constructing a reality that is, I want to say artificial, but it conceals something, but it's not like it's fake. It's not the holodeck. It's not an illusion. Day-to-day life is what it is, right? You know, it's got all of the infrastructure, and it's got all of the services that define our sort of political public reality. And then there's all the stuff that happens behind the scenes in government that we don't necessarily know about. And it's not like one is true and one is false. They both exist, except one feels like it's manufactured, it's constructed. It's an illusion, but it's not illusion in the sense of being false. It is, you know, those things are a part of our reality. They're just artificially constructed.
And I think that's a very fair way of putting it.
To the point where we can't distinguish between what's true and what's false, and what's true and what's a mere illusion.
And that was kind of the point that I was making about history in general, because, again, you know, we see history from a single perspective. And so it's very, very difficult. I'll give you an example, and I will use a very dark, I believe a very dark chapter from American history. you know, for instance, you know, we all were in grade school and we all probably at one time or another participated in, you know, that day around Thanksgiving when we make the little paper hats for like the pilgrims, and some people make the little headdresses like the Indians, and we have this.
I made a construction paper turkey from my hand.
I did the same thing. I still have it, by the way. And
oh, good.
Yeah.
So I'm glad you have yours. I'll have mine vicariously through you.
But I remember I was about 19 when I went to see a presentation of a historical event, or events, I should say, from the perspective of the Cherokee Indian Nation. The presentation was entitled Unto These Hills, and I saw something that really changed my perspective in many, many ways, because I sat in a public school classroom. You know, we saw this kind of sensationalized sort of history, you know, manifest destiny and all of that stuff from a single perspective. But now I'm watching the brutality of the Trail of Tears, and I was horrified, and I left that presentation. It was an outdoor drama. I left that presentation angry and in some ways disillusioned, and it really forced me to re-examine the history of our country and the impact that we had on Native American tribes, and not looking at it from just the perspective of, you know, the good old USA public school ideology, but rather looking at it in search of something more meaningful, and that was the truth. And the truth is that there are two stories to be told there, two perspectives to see those events through, and the truth is somewhere in the middle. And so that was very eye-opening. And, you know, so that was my point on looking back at history.
Well, applying this to the situation that Commander Riker is in, both in the Pegasus and in These Are the Voyages, it almost sounds like we're dispensing with the notion that there's a simplistic concept of truth and falsehood, one interpretation being correct, the other interpretation being false about historical events. You know, certainly nations have this perspective, right? Our nation's perspective, another nation's perspective. We can apply this to Riker. We've got the situation of, we've got Riker's perspective on what the truth is. We have Admiral Pressman's perspective and what the truth of the matter is about this cloaking mm-hmm. device. We have the Romulans' perspective. We have the Organians' perspective.
Yes.
Right? So when we overly simplify and we say it's a matter of Riker telling the truth to Captain Picard, and that's the, you know, the moral force of the situation, is that an oversimplification of the reality of truth and its sort of perspectival nature, the fact that there's not just a truth of the matter, there's these different perspectives on the truth, and Riker has one, and Pressman has another one, and Picard has one, and the Romulans have one, and the Organians have one. So whose truth matters more than the others? Because Pressman's truth is very different. He's got a quasi-political, quasi-militaristic perspective on truth, right? This new technology is an important part of maintaining the security of the Federation, and that is part of his truth. That's part of the worldview that he has. Mm-hmm. Why is that perspective any less valid than Captain Picard's perspective that Commander Riker should just tell him the truth about the cloaking device?
Well, and then you begin to break down those truths and weigh them against various moral and ethical points of view. And what you end up doing, Zachary, is you end up refining truth, in irony quotes, into something that resembles something a bit more applicable, something a bit more, I don't want to use the word universal, but, you know, something I think that's a bit more applicable.
It's almost reminiscent of the discussions that have been going on for the last 20 or 30 years about open source information versus closed access to information.
Yeah, good point.
To what extent are we entitled to knowledge or to facts about reality? And to what extent should those be hidden or concealed from certain people? Mm-hmm. You know, there's the open source crowd, and then there's the, you know, need to know crowd. and this seems like a sort of microcosm of that broader discussion, right? If you appeal to truth for its own sake, you're more in the open source crowd. Like, tell the truth, get it out there, we'll work on it together. Captain Picard seems to be in that camp. Riker ends up in that camp. But Pressman is in the need-to-know basis camp.
Zachary, it suddenly occurred to me, I mean completely mind-blown here. It just occurred to me that maybe that's the whole reason why this episode seems forced. Because it is actually, these are the redacted voyages. That's what we're watching here.
These are the redacted voyages.
I mean, we just don't have open. We just can't have open source hologram simulations, Zachary. we can't have that.
No open source captain's logs.
No open source captain's logs. You know, so Riker got the redacted version, I think.
You know, when you're talking about truth in this sense, there are two perspectives you can take. There is truth in this kind of idealistic pure sense, the Kantian sense, or maybe the Cartesian sense. Mm-hmm. You know, just the bare truth, uninterpreted, unfiltered truth in a very modernistic kind of sense, right? Truth with a big capital T. And then there's truth in the political sense, the things that we don't want out there in the world, the things that are too difficult to deal with, the things that we don't talk about in public, right? These
like low, aliens smaller, and that sort of thing.
Aliens or government secrets or whatever it is, right? Yeah. The things that are not out there for public consumption, not open for public consideration.
Sure.
I think any government's perspective is likely that there are certain things that the public doesn't need to know. And that is a sort of governmental, political way of thinking about truth. Truth is a commodity. Truth is something that you bargain with to obtain political power, or truth is something that you manufacture for the sake of creating a certain kind of reality. It's not there that there's any sort of bare, unfiltered truth of the matter. It's just interesting to see these two interpretations of truth juxtaposed in the same episode, because Captain Picard seems to have this lofty notion of truth for its own sake and, you know, almost consequences be damned. You know, we'll expose the Federation secrets. And if that means we're going to be in less of a position to deal with the Romulans someday, then so be it.
And that's not the first time that Picard's taken that perspective, that point of view.
No, absolutely, but Admiral Pressman doesn't have that perspective on it. He's inherently political, and truth is not something to be prized above any of these other practical concerns that he has. And they're good practical concerns, right? He has the burden of keeping the Federation safe. He has the burden of making sure the Federation is prepared to fight a war with the Romulans if necessary. And that's a difficult situation to be in. It's a lot of weight to put on your shoulders. I think in this episode, it's easy to underappreciate that Admiral Pressman has a big weight on his shoulders, right? He has been charged in some sense, in some sphere, of developing something that will keep the Federation secure. And he probably does. He's not a terrible person. He probably does feel the burden of all of the lives around him that ride on developing this new technology. Or at least he thinks that those lives ride on developing the new technology. So truth for him is more a matter of those practical realities than it is about anything idealistic and pure and Kantian or Cartesian.
But when I watch the Pegasus by itself, I walk away from that episode with this thought that Pressman has become so warped by these conflicting obligations and ideas that he doesn't even recognize the difference between right and wrong anymore. And I think that's probably what most fans, I think, would say walking away from that episode. I don't think I'm in the minority here on that.
And I think this is the interesting shift from what we see in the Pegasus to what we see in These Are the Voyages. Part of the genius of Commander Riker going into the holodeck and hearing these interpersonal relationships amongst the Enterprise crew, all the stuff that the crew tells him when he's playing the role of chef, all of the events he sees in Tripp's willingness to sacrifice himself for Captain Archer, it reminds him of the concept of loyalty. And so you summarized this earlier in the episode, but the juxtaposition between truth for its own sake and loyalty.
Sure.
I think Commander Riker comes to realize that, you know, he's got a loyalty to Captain Picard above and beyond what he ever had for Pressman.
I agree with you completely. And I'll say again, I think the fact that he is able to, I mean, we don't, Zachary, you and I don't have a holodeck to go in and experience this in, but I do believe that we can do this in many ways without a holodeck, and that is to sit down and, be it something that we read or perhaps a documentary or something that we watch that has to do with history, and just put ourselves in those places, in those moments in our minds, and look at it from varying perspectives. I think there's a great deal of value in that. And the fact that we see Riker doing that, I think in many, many ways, all work together to inform the decision that he comes to at the end of the episode.
Yeah, I think the shift from truth to loyalty is fascinating, because in the Pegasus, it does seem to be more about truth.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Coming clean about this conspiracy theory about the Pegasus. Right. And ultimately Riker decides to, quote unquote, tell the truth to Captain Picard. But that doesn't really explain why he's spending so much time having these deep interpersonal conversations with the holographic Enterprise crew. Right. About seemingly trivial things in some ways, yeah. Too. I mean, you know, just kind of getting to know them as people, listening to their stories, listening to them talk about each other and their relationships to each other. And none of that is directly relevant to the situation that he's facing back on the Enterprise D in real life, quote unquote. So why is he spending so much time doing it? And I think that accounts for some of this kind of plot disconnect between what we see in the Enterprise D and what we see in Enterprise, right? These two supposedly analogous situations. But maybe we're making the case for the fact that it's a better analogy than we originally thought, right? If the fundamental issue is not so much truth and breaking orders as it is loyalty, then all of these interpersonal stories and these close friendships and these interpersonal relationships and people telling their secrets to Chef and just witnessing the close connection amongst the Enterprise crew, I feel like maybe Riker's internalized some of that, and he steps back into the Enterprise D and he can apply all of that to what he sees around him, you know, his friendships and his commanding officer and the things that, not just that he thinks about truth and what his responsibility is, but what he feels emotionally about those people and his commander and what he feels about the truth as opposed to truth for its own sake.
We've talked about this several times on the podcast. One of the numerous things that you and I have in common, one of the things that we share, is a love for genealogy. And I know it's true for me, and I guess I want to ask you if it's true for you. As you learn, I'm not talking about, you know, the date of birth or date of death, but as you're researching genealogy and as you learn more of the interpersonal stories of your ancestors, does it affect your perspective the way it does mine?
I think there's a sense in which you make those people's stories your own.
Yes.
You know, they are a part of my story, because I think you come to realize that none of what you have today would be here if it hadn't been for everything that came before. And the same is true in Star Trek, right? What we know as the Federation and 24th century life in Star Trek The Next Generation was contingent on all of this messy stuff that happened in Enterprise. And it's interesting to see Commander Riker kind of go back and take, you know, the people and a couple of events and weave those into his own story in some way. So I think absolutely. But there's a sense in which it's always a little whitewashed. You know, people don't tend to, you know, record the messy parts of life. They record the sure. the easy on the ears stories, right? And so it's interesting that you know, as we have a more and more detailed records of people's actual lives, mm-hmm. I think the messy stories get recorded and get codified a little, almost as much as the positive ones. I don't think that's always been true in genealogy. If you look 150, 200 years, your ancestors, you might have one or two stories that are notorious or nefarious, but mm-hmm. Generally you're going to get, you know, a lot of easy on the ears stuff, names and dates and where people lived sure. and, you know, what they did for a living. And it's all very, very quaint, right? But you forget how messy life really is. And once in a while you get a messy story that's remembered along with the easy on the ears stories. So I think, yes, it's easy to internalize the easy on the ears story. It's not as easy to internalize the stories that are a little messier that don't get recorded as often in genealogy. And I think, you know, now that we live in this technological age where we record history almost 24/7, you know, you can find a camera looking at pretty much anything around the mm-hmm. world 24/7. All of our world's history is being recorded in real time right now. Really, I mean, that's something we forget about, that, you know, generally there's a camera looking at pretty much everything.
Yeah.
And you know, it's easy to forget that we have that accurate of a historical record. What does that mean for our future interpretation of current events? I have no idea. Like, I always assumed that this recreation on the holodeck was more like historical record and less like fiction, because presumably they had cameras on the Enterprise, and mm-hmm. they're at least as technologically advanced as we are, and they have all that information. So it's a little closer to history than fiction. What does that mean for Commander Riker? Well, that's a messy situation that he's looking at on Enterprise, right? Commander Tucker gets killed. There's a dangerous situation. It's a turning point in history. But it all hinges on this really messy event that's easy to forget about, right? It's easy to talk about the, you know, the signing of the Federation Charter. That makes us very happy and warm and fuzzy, right? It's not as easy to talk about these messy events that lead up to the signing of the Federation Charter. And to choose to focus on those messy events as opposed to the easy on the ears events is an interesting choice, because most of life is a little messy like that. So I think when you look at history, it's probably important to look at the messy history and not just the clean and tidy history.
Well, I ask you that question, Zachary, for this very reason. And thank you for your answer, because you affirmed for me exactly why it's just not good enough for me to know the date my second great grandfather was born and the date that he died. I want to know his story. And as I learn these stories, they really are, as you said, part of my own. It gives me a deeper appreciation for where I'm at and what I have and who I mm-hmm. am. And so I really appreciate the fact that within this episode, Riker is not simply looking at that one big grandiose event, you know, the signing of the Federation Charter, but rather he's interested in Tucker's personal story. All of the conversations that he kind of has, he has it with T'Pol. There's that scene where he's chef and he's talking to her about, you know, their relationship. Do you miss him? And when he's talking to Hoshi, what did you think of him? Did you think he was cute? And he's talking to Phlox, and Phlox is having to tell him about, oh yes, I had to order him to relax many times. And, you know, so
that was a pretty good Phlox impersonation there, Mike,
thank
actually.
You. Optimism, Captain. But he's interested in his personal story. He's making it his own, I think. And I think that he's discovering within what I believe probably would have been a minor historical figure. I mean, let's face it. We all know the General Washingtons of the world, but we don't know the name of the guy who marched behind his horse barefooted. We don't know that guy's name. But in this case, in Star Trek Enterprise, that man's name was Charles Tucker III. And he gave his life to save his captain. and to ensure that he made that charter signing on time. And I love the fact that Riker is diving into his story and he's getting to know him and he's making his story, Tucker's story, part of his own.
It's almost a Greatest Generation kind of story, right? I think there have been times in history where people knew they were doing great things. The signers of the Declaration of Independence knew what they were doing, right? They knew the risks involved. They knew what they hoped to accomplish. It was very conscious. I think the soldiers and airmen that went out and fought in World War II knew what they were doing to some extent. They had a cause. They believed in it. They knew that something great was going to happen. It's messy. War is always messy. But there was a sense of the greatness of the moment. And I get the sense in this episode that the Enterprise crew was very aware of the greatness of the moment that they were about to undertake, right? The signing of the Federation Charter. It's, yes, it's just a piece of paper. You go sign the charter and, you know, this new thing is created. You can totally trivialize and minimalize, you know, what that event could be. But they've really sold it to us in the episode, right? This is a big moment, and they know that this is going to have an impact on all of the future history, not just of Earth, but of other planets. They're creating something,
and there's some energy behind it. As much. They say as much in the episode.
They speculate about it. They believe in it. There's a purpose to it. And I get the sense that they just know that there's something larger than themselves going on. So Trip being willing to sacrifice himself for Archer, I think, has two components to it. One is this personal loyalty to his friend. And that is, I think that's a non-trivial part of the episode, right? He's willing to sacrifice himself for his captain and his friend. But there's also a sense of the greatness of the moment. They know that this is a turning point in the history of Earth and their own society, and it's a moment for the future. They're creating something for posterity. And Trip is willing to sacrifice himself so Captain Archer, not just to save his friend, but so Captain Archer can be there at that moment in history and make the future happen.
So my last observation question, if you will, has to do with something that Deanna Troi says very near the end of the episode. You know, we see that Jonathan Archer, as is typical for him, he has procrastinated. He has put off writing this speech, and he's pacing back and forth. T'Pol's trying to get him dressed and, you know, get him ready to go out for his big moment in history. And in some ways, Archer's kind of downplaying the whole thing. He's barely gotten his speech written, let alone memorized, and she's chastising him a little bit for it. And so then we go to Deanna Troi, who just casually mentions that, oh, you know, I had to memorize this speech when I was in grade school. Do you think to some degree, Zachary, we put too much emphasis on history in that regard? At least maybe the sensationalized version of history. So much the same way that Troi is reminiscing about having to learn this, you know, memorize this speech that Archer didn't even bother to memorize. And he gave it, barely had the thing written. And yet, you know, a couple hundred years later, and, you know, she's having to memorize it in grade school. Do you think we put too much emphasis on history in that regard?
I think it boils down to your perspective on what history is. If history is a series of messy, loosely associated perspectives without some unifying theme, then yeah, maybe we place too much emphasis on those grand moments and those speeches and those narratives and whatnot. If you think that history is driven by ideas, purposes, and causes, you know, things that are bigger than any one person's perspective or any one nation's perspective, then you might be a little more sympathetic, I think, to that approach to history, to focusing on those grand events. Because I think you can look back in history and realize that there were times where people knew they were trying to do something great. You know, humans had an idea, came together, tried to accomplish something, largely did accomplish some things in the process. And if you ignore those for the sake of perspectives, you lose an important part of why those events happened. So you wouldn't want to avoid talking about those things. But I think focusing solely on those just ignores the complexity of historical events, this rich historical tapestry of perspectives and context that is important, an important part of genuinely understanding what's going on. So it's a little bit of both. I think, yeah, we do tend to oversimplify, but you wouldn't want to lose this concept that history can be driven by ideas as much as it can be driven by perspectives.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I'm like many many people from my generation who had to learn, for instance, the Gettysburg Address that was, you know, scribbled on a napkin. And I don't think at the time Lincoln realized the weight that speech would carry throughout history. And yet, you know, we're still memorizing it to this day in schools across the United States. But I do have to wonder sometimes, and I'm not using the Gettysburg Address as an example of this, but, you know, I do have to wonder sometimes if we put so much emphasis on the memorizing of speeches and dates and, you know, we've all taken history tests where, you know, we had to, what was the date of the signing of the Magna Carta? What difference does it make? What was the Magna? You know, if I were to poll, you know, the average, you know, seventh or eighth grader, they probably know the date of the signing of the Magna Carta, but do they know what the Magna Carta meant? Do they know what it was about? Do they know the historical importance of it? And so, you know, I see Troy saying, "Hey, I had to memorize this," and it struck me as funny because she memorized this speech as a grade school student that he barely had written, let alone memorized.
I do think there's some value in memorizing speeches.
I do,
or at least remembering speeches, because I think the hope is that, insofar as those speeches contain ideals, the hope is that in remembering them, that those ideals will be internalized in some mm-hmm. way. Now, they aren't always, of course. Some people just, you know, repeat the speech back by rote and it doesn't sink in. Absolutely, there's always going to be people like that. But I do think there's value in taking the time to remember those kinds of things. It's funny you mentioned the Gettysburg Address. I actually recently came across it's the Gettysburg Address done as the world's most boring corporate PowerPoint presentation to make a point about communication styles. You know, there's a reason that certain speeches stick with us. Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech.
Yes.
Or in this episode, Captain Archer's These Are the Voyages of the Starship Enterprise speech, right? Those words resonate with us. And I think the point in memorizing speeches and repeating them, like I remember I had to recite the preamble to the Constitution.
Yes.
In fourth grade. I still remember that. I don't know if I could do it now. Probably not. But I think you learn to experience the loftiness of the ideals that those speeches are supposed to represent, and they're supposed to move us emotionally. They're performative. Right, the goal is not just to memorize. The goal is to experience those speeches, and that's essentially what Riker almost does inside the episode before he ends the program, is experience this grand speech that Captain Archer is about to give. That's memorable. That's analogous to the Gettysburg Address, or analogous to the signing of the Declaration of Independence. Right, and maybe analogous to Martin Luther King's speech. Something really grand and lofty, and with high ideals. That's not something you memorize. That's something you experience.
But Zachary, did you have to memorize the opening words of the Canterbury Tales in the original English?
No, but something tells me you did.
I most certainly did. And I'm 47 years old now, and I still have it stuck in my brain.
I've always been terrible at memorizing speeches. This is why I could never be an actor. I couldn't remember lines to save my life.
One that Apriel with his surest suitor, the druid of Merch, hath perished to the rooter, and bothered every vine and switch liqueur of which virtue engendered is the fleur.
Could you do some Captain Archer in Old English? Maybe a little Jean-Luc Picard in Old English?
We'll save that for maybe Phlox in Old English.
Something tells me Patrick Stewart could do that.
Patrick Stewart would make me look like an amateur. It'd be amateur hour. Well, Zachary, it's been fun talking about These Are the Voyages today, but this isn't the only thing that we've been discussing here on the network, so here's a quick look, everyone, at some other things you may have missed elsewhere on Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm, the Orb.
DS9's second visit to the Mirror Universe wasn't simply that, hey, that was fun, we did that in Season 2, why don't we do that again? Let's go to the Mirror Universe, let's just make it a thing. It was, let's go back and find out what were the consequences of that first crossover, and then let's build upon that. And that, again, is one of the things that I think the DS9 writers do so well that we don't always see on other series.
Earl Grey.
I want to start with something a little bit different. The first thing I want to start with is to go around and ask everybody something that they love about Nemesis. So, Zach, you want to start?
Sure.
I know it's a challenge.
That was a pregnant pause.
I hope he doesn't say the credits.
Oh, no.
Literary Treks.
To me, and I kind of thought this more as we got further into the book, it really felt like a narrative computer game almost, where you find all these clues and you visit these rooms and then you have to visit the rooms again and all that. And we'll get into the main plot of what they do later in the book, but yeah, this setup, I love the mystery. I'm really enjoying, like, what's going on? What happened here?
The 602 Club.
You know, what's really interesting is I have shown this to my kids. This is the one I held on to. This is like Revenge of the Sith, where I was like, you got to get to a certain... I got to know you're going to be able to, you know, sort of like hang on to this and not, you know, go too far with it and get freaked out and stuff. And what's so fascinating, and I think back to when I was a kid and I saw this, that the heart scene, you know, the famous Mole Rom taking the heart out scene, that was fascinating.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and join the conversation about your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button in Apple Podcasts on iPhone, iPad, Apple TV, or the desktop iTunes app to get the latest episodes as soon as they're published. And please leave us a star rating and written review. Those help us tremendously. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Google Play Music, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and most third-party podcast apps. And you can always stream and download the MP3 file from our website or grab the RSS link as well. We'd love to hear your thoughts on today's show, and there are many ways that you can mind meld with us. The best place to join the larger conversation is always the Babel Conference, our listeners-only group on Facebook. Just type Babel, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, and it should come right up. One of our admins will let you right in, just ask to join. If you'd like to send us an email, you can use the contact form on our website at trek.fm/contact. Choose Message to a Trek FM Show and select Metatreks. That'll come right to us. You can also find the network on Twitter at Trek FM and on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm. So, Zachary, when you're not playing the part of chef on the Enterprise holodeck, where can people find you around Trek FM and on the interwebs?
Well, you can find me elsewhere on Trek.fm as co-host of To the Journey, Trek FM's podcast dedicated to all things Star Trek Voyager. You can always find me in the Babel Conference if you'd like to talk about Star Trek and philosophy with me in there, and you're welcome to follow me on Twitter. My handle is just my name, at Zachary Fruhling. That's Zachary, Z-A-C-H-A-R-Y, Fruhling, F-R-U-H-L-I-N-G. And how about you, Mike? When you're not busy redacting our previous episodes of Metatreks, where can our listeners find you on the interwebs and around the Trek FM network?
I'm missing 20 minutes of tape somewhere. I can't find it anywhere.
That's what you do as an editor. You basically redact our conversations.
Yes.
I know. One day we'll release an uncut episode of Metatreks and people will be shocked.
Yes, the Watergate versions. Yes. Well, Zachary, you can always find me on Facebook. That's where I'm most active. Certainly on Twitter. My Twitter handle is at cmichael1701. I'm occasionally on Instagram, cmichael1701 there as well. If you'd like to help us keep our shows coming to you each week, you can become a patron of the network on Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm to get all the details. Perks include things like early access to episodes, exclusive content, producer credits, and many more. All available through our special patrons website, Patron Zone. It does require a great deal of time and money to produce, host, and distribute these shows each month, so we really appreciate any support you can give us, and we hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. Well, Zachary, we'd like to take a moment to acknowledge the rest of the MetaTreks team from around the network. Specifically, we'd like to thank C. Brian Jones, founder and publisher of Trek FM, a man who always looks heroic. Executive producers Matthew Rushing and Ken Tripp, Aaron Harvey, our art director, Richard Marquez, our production manager, and our Patreon manager, Brandon Shea Mutala. We'd also like to give a special shout out to our associate producers, Patrick Devlin, at MagicDrop5 on Twitter, Kay Shaw, her Twitter handle is at ChocoWeeble, Norman Lau, you can connect with him at Starfighter1701, and Mark Walker, still from parts unknown. And Zachary, we'd like to once more invite our listeners to discover more about our sponsor, Enterprise in Space, a project of the nonprofit National Space Society. Visit enterpriseinspace.org to find out more and to get your seat on the mission. And check out audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for your desktop or mobile device. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. Well, thanks everyone for listening to MetaTreks, a Star Trek and philosophy podcast. Until next time, when we will once again boldly go where no philosophers have gone before.